Welcome to your Aged Care Compass podcast. We help you make sense of the Australian aged care system by having conversations about topics you've asked us about. We're joined by thought leaders, professional experts, and people just like you and I who talk about their experience in the aged care sector. Welcome to today's episode of your Aged Care Compass podcast. I'm Coral, your host, and today I'm joined by Dr. Kailas Roberts. Kailas is a psychiatrist with a particular interest in brain health and dementia, and he's the author of Mind Your Brain, The Essential Australian Guide to Dementia. He has been working as a doctor for over 20 years and has more than 10 years' experience in assessing and treating patients with cognitive difficulties. Kailas runs a busy private practice and memory clinic in Western Brisbane and consults at a number of local nursing homes. Kailas, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Coral.
You joined me last year for an excellent episode about understanding dementia. However, today we're going to be discussing two other conditions that can mimic the signs of dementia and also coexist with dementia. First of all, let's just begin with a recap on what dementia is.
Sure. So dementia is a misunderstood term, and I suspect your listeners are hopefully increasingly familiar with what we mean by it. But dementia is essentially a description of a syndrome where there is some sort of cognitive problem, which is often memory, but not always memory. It can be language, visuospatial skills, and so on, that causes a problem with day-to-day functioning. So there are lots of causes of dementia, Alzheimer's disease being the most common. There's vascular disease, Lewy body dementia, frontotemporal dementia. So the dementia itself is not a diagnosis. It just really describes this clinical syndrome. Often people refer to it as sort of an umbrella term, really. And then under that umbrella are all these different causes of dementia.
Great. And what is delirium, Kailas?
So delirium is distinct from dementia, although as we'll talk about, there is quite a degree of overlap between the two. But delirium is used to be known, and also sometimes is still known, as an acute confusional state. And really the acute bit of that is probably the critical point. So there are certainly similarities between the way that dementia and delirium can present, but they're very different phenomena. In theory, delirium is something that if you can get on top of it, then you will essentially resolve it. You'll be able to cure it. Whereas dementia, of course, is a progressive, incurable condition. So it's a very different sort of pathophysiological process, if you like, but there's overlap between the two.
And depression. How would you describe depression?
So depression is a mood disorder, if you like. So when I talk about depression and clinical depression, it's really not so much the general feelings of sort of sadness that we all get from time to time. It's more of a state where there are a number of symptoms, including pervasively low moods, a mood that's kind of low every day that can be quite severe. And there is a number of associated symptoms you may have with that, such as feelings of hopelessness, lack of motivation, lack of enjoyment in things, fatigue, possibly sort of sleep disturbance, appetite changes, and so on. So it's quite a sort of distinct, again, there are interfaces between delirium and depression and dementia as well, but it's a different phenomenon again.
Okay, so we know that these three conditions are separate conditions, but they can present similarly. Can you talk us through how these conditions can present similarly?
Yeah, well, I think if we talk about the cognitive side of things, then you can have cognitive problems with all of them, really. So in delirium and dementia, the cognitive problem is probably the key thing. In depression, it's not really the key factor, but you can certainly get cognitive problems in depression as well. So as I was mentioning before, cognition includes things like memory, but also things like attention and various other sort of skills as well. And all of these can be impacted within those conditions. So in all of those conditions, you can have impairment of attention. So you just find it harder to focus on things. You can have increased forgetfulness as well. So just not really remembering things very well. And you can have impairment of what we call sort of executive function, where it's just harder to really problem solve and work through more complex tasks. So they do all present quite similarly in some ways, but there are also distinctions between the three in terms of the way the cognitive factors are affected.
Excellent. So if a doctor is presented with a person exhibiting some memory loss, some tiredness or fatigue, and perhaps loss in doing the things they previously liked to do, what investigations would a doctor focus on if they were establishing if a person had an emerging cognitive impairment or a mood disorder, or both, if that was the case?
Maybe just before we talk about the investigations, if it's okay, it might just be worth talking about the history itself, because actually the history is often the thing that really gives the clue as to what's going on. So when I was mentioning before about the differences in terms of how these things present, and I said at the outset about delirium being acute sort of an event, then in the history, you can get a story from the person or their caregiver of this sort of sudden change that might then indicate it's more likely to be a delirium, because it's unusual in dementia, for instance, to have this sudden change in kind of cognitive function. So understanding the time frame and the onset of symptoms as part of the history, I think, is really important. Understanding a little bit about the nature of the cognitive changes and how they're presenting day to day is also important. So you, in a state of delirium, for instance, it's often very fluctuating. So you may see these quite significant changes in people's ability to remember and pay attention and things throughout the period of the day. Whereas in dementia, although there's some variability, and often, of course, people are maybe worse off sort of the end of the day, it tends to be a bit more sort of predictable and stable. And in depression as well, often there is some fluctuation, but not to the degree that there is in delirium. Classically, actually, depression, the cognitive symptoms seem to be worse in the morning, as opposed to dementia, where the cognitive symptoms are worse later in the day. So there's these sort of distinctions between the way that the cognitive symptoms present, and that, I think, can be really picked up in the history a lot of the time. But they are quite difficult conditions to differentiate, even for somebody who's got a lot of experience in the field like myself. I mean, sometimes it's not really obvious from the history whether one of those conditions is the primary issue, or whether two of them are coexistent, or whether, in fact, all three of them are there at the same time. So the investigations can be very helpful. And what we're doing, I suppose, with the investigations is looking for things that may be causing delirium specifically, and then looking for some evidence that there may be a sort of underlying dementia process. I think when we're looking at the causes of delirium, there are a number of other causes, and investigations can pick these up. So we're looking for things like signs of covert infection. So we can do full blood counts, for instance, that will sort of pick that up. We can do inflammatory markers, things like CRP and ESR. So we can pick all those things up in a blood test. Even disturbances of electrolytes, such as low sodium, can cause a state of delirium. So there are a number of kind of factors that we can, I guess, pick up on blood tests, urine tests as well. Classically, you know, as you get older, you're much more vulnerable to urinary tract infections, particularly if you're female. And that's a very common cause of delirium as well. So we're sort of getting a number of blood tests done and urine tests done to look at possible underlying causes of delirium. Coming back to the history for a minute, I forgot to mention, but, you know, medication changes can also induce a state of delirium in people. So you're looking for things like that as well. Then you may, and I suppose I have a fairly low threshold to obtain some neuroimaging, so some brain scans of some sort, preferably an MRI, sometimes a CT. And they're not classically going to show up as causes of delirium, but they may have some evidence of some underlying changes that may represent a dementia process occurring. So I suppose that's the way that I sort of approach things. We try and get a really robust history, do some blood tests, we do urine tests, and then most of the time we'll get the neuroimaging done as well, acknowledging that there might be more than one thing going on. The depression side of things, I mean, that's not really something that we would often necessarily pick up in blood tests, except to say that there are certain conditions such as low thyroid disease or low iron, things like that, anemia, which can sort of create a sort of depressive type presentation where there's a sort of lack of energy and a lack of enthusiasm for things. So we can sort of indirectly pick things up through those investigations as well.
And if a doctor thought that the person was depressed, would they treat the depression first before determining if the person had dementia?
They should, for sure. And I suppose one of the things there is that, as we mentioned, depression can cause cognitive problems that look like dementia. There's even a term that we use called depressive pseudo-dementia, which is really a case where the depression is actually the cause of the memory problems. And so I think it is important as best you can to sort of try and exclude and treat depression as a cause of the memory loss before then certainly concluding that dementia might be present. Probably also worth pointing out here, if I can, that there's this, the relationship between all those three conditions is quite complicated. So they can exist independently, you can have all three of them together, or sometimes the periods of confusion, i.e. the delirium, or even periods of depression can be harbingers, basically, of a dementia process. So what we sometimes see is that if you have been sort of mentally well for many years and then you start developing depression for the first time later in life, for some people, definitely not for everybody, but for some people, that is actually a sign that the brain is just not working as well and can actually portend a later dementia process occurring. And similarly with delirium, because the brain is vulnerable through an underlying dementia process, you're more likely to develop delirium as well. And this is sometimes what we see, that we have people that have recurrent delirium, and then when you actually look at them when they're well, the brain is already vulnerable because they have some underlying dementia type process occurring. And if they hadn't have had that, possibly the impact of the urinary tract infection or whatever the cause of delirium is would not have been as pronounced. So there is this kind of interesting sort of background that exists that means that depression and delirium can be these very early signals of a dementia process occurring.
It's very complicated, as you just mentioned, but I'm loving how clearly you're describing the differences for the listeners. I think they're going to really appreciate your description of these terms, of these conditions, Kailas. So let's talk about delirium now. How does delirium mimic dementia?
So I think it's those shared cognitive symptoms that we talk about. That's the way in which delirium looks like dementia or mimics dementia. So the problems with memory, the problems with attention, sometimes just the sort of change in behavior and demeanor of a person. So that the not so obviously directly cognitive symptoms, they are shared features as well. So there is certainly commonality, I suppose, in some of the symptoms. I should probably mention, although it's relatively rare, there is a condition called Lewy body dementia, which actually very closely mimics a delirium. So in Lewy body dementia, you have these rapidly sort of fluctuating states of cognition, so periods of confusion followed by periods of quite reasonable lucidity. And then in those times of confusion, there might be less awareness or less alertness on the part of the person as well. So Lewy body dementia is a very specific type of dementia that looks very much like delirium, and it's kind of quite difficult to tease those things apart. But yeah, I suppose the similarities in general between delirium and dementia mainly come down to those sort of cognitive changes.
So having worked in acute hospital settings, I was very aware of delirium as I worked with older people, and my dad experienced delirium each time he was hospitalised over the last 2 years of his life. Dad was restless, he was agitated, and he had terrible hallucinations each time he was in hospital. So this is a picture of delirium that more people are likely to be aware of, but a person might be lethargic or withdrawn as well. Could you please describe a hypoactive delirium and why it's important that caregivers and family members be aware of this kind of presentation as well?
Community pharmacies keep Australia healthy. With 6,000 locations nationwide, they're open early, late, and longer for convenient, accessible, and safe care. Pharmacists provide home medicine reviews, dose administration aids, and essential vaccinations. Thanks to additional training, many can now treat common conditions like ear infections, wounds, and skin issues. They also support management of chronic conditions in partnership with your healthcare team. Ask your pharmacist how they can help you and your family stay well.
Yeah, I think first of all, it's probably good to point out how common delirium is in hospitalised people as well. I mean, it's very common. So some estimates suggest sort of 25 to 30% of people that are in hospital have some form of delirium. Also very common in aged care facilities as well. And I think part of the problem there is that, I mean, it does go unrecognised if it is one of these hypoactive deliriums. So in the hyperactive delirium, which is kind of the classic one, where there's obviously changes and there's often agitation and this, as you said, sort of response to hallucinations and things, which is very overt, it's fairly obvious that there's something wrong with the person and that they need to be helped. Whereas in a hypoactive delirium, often the presentation is much more of this quiet, withdrawn, not engaging person. And so that, as you can imagine, in a busy hospital or aged care facility, that can be completely missed. So I think that the hypoactive delirium is a sort of hidden type of delirium in a way. I mean, it's not something that we pick up as readily as the hyperactive delirium. But of course, it's the same process going on with the body. It's still as dangerous, as problematic, and as impactful on a sort of personal level as the hyperactive delirium.
Carlos, what is the management of delirium?
So there are different approaches. First of all, it's important that there are the right sort of environment is put into place. And unfortunately, again, this is something where, or sometimes where hospitals fall down, but really having visual cues in your environment to reorient the person is really helpful. So even things, one of the, I guess, hallmark features of delirium is this disorientation in time and place. And so not being aware of when it is or where they are, those are quite frightening, as you can imagine, sort of feelings that people get. And so having reorientation techniques such as signs on the doors or clocks on the wall, things with dates and things like that, that's really important to have that environmental variable covered. Also having areas where there's no extra impairment of sensory inputs. So having a room that's well lit, for instance, is far better than having a darker room where, again, it's quite hard to kind of make sense of your surroundings. So I think they're the important environmental variables, or some of them. The next part of management is trying to understand what's going on. So what is the cause of the delirium? And this is not always obvious, but a lot of the time, as we mentioned, there's some sort of medical issue. So you need to try and investigate and treat those things as well. So that's the most helpful thing in terms of treating delirium, is understanding what the cause of it is and dealing with that. And then the rest of it is really more supportive care. So that takes the form, ideally, of not involving drugs to actually help sedate people and so on. Like, you want to avoid those things if possible. And quite often those styles of medications make things worse, although there's a role for them, and I'll come on to it in just a minute. But it's mainly around trying to have close nursing supervision in those situations and being able to support and be empathic and be consistently sort of reorienting the person, making sure obviously that they're kind of drinking and eating okay, because if they're not, that may sort of exacerbate the problem. So the non-pharmacological approach to dementia involves those sort of variables. But if we do need to use medications, and there are some that are better than others, the times I think we would use these are really when there's a real threat of aggression, or there's a risk that the person poses to themselves or others indirectly because of the illness and the confusional state that they're in. Classically, people are often given things like Valium or have been in the past, and those things unfortunately just make the situation worse by inducing more confusion. So sometimes we would use sort of very low doses of antipsychotics as a temporary kind of measure if risk issues are involved. But those are the three sort of approaches. I mean, if you can avoid medications, that's obviously the best outcome.
And how long can it take for a delirium to resolve?
This is quite interesting. And I think although it is an acute confusional state, there often is, that's the onset really. And there's often a really long tail end to delirium. And again, this might be influenced by whether there's something else going on. So if you do have an underlying dementia, the delirium and the impact of it is likely to be longer. So it might resolve within a few days, but sometimes it takes weeks, sometimes even months to completely resolve. And so if it was a urinary tract infection, for instance, understandably people feel that once you treat the infection, it should all be over very quickly. But it's not. You know, we do see this very long tail. And again, when we're sort of trying to understand whether there is another process going on, such as a dementia, we do need to leave quite a long period of time because of that before actually making any sort of conclusive judgments about these things. I've certainly seen in my clinic people who have had some sort of physiological insult that's led to a delirium, and I'm seeing them 6 weeks later and they're clearly still delirious, but they've been sent to me for an assessment of dementia, and I really can't make that whilst they're in that kind of state of delirium. So yeah, a long time sometimes.
Yeah, thank you, Carlos. I recall Dad had Alzheimer's disease, and when his deliriums coincided with his hospital admissions, and it was very difficult. And it wasn't until about the 2 months post-hospital discharge that we started to see Dad come back to us. So it did take quite some time, certainly for Dad, for that delirium to resolve with him.
Yeah.
So what options do people have to manage their depression if that's the diagnosis?
So I think it depends on the extent of the depression. Again, I think there are lots of environmental variables that can help and lots of more lifestyle-based things that can help. And it's really important to point those out. So we do live in an era where we're very quick to medicate things like depression, and there probably is an overprescription of things like antidepressants. So they definitely have their place. But, you know, we sometimes lose track of the basics in terms of lifestyle that can actually be really helpful for depression. So making sure that you're exercising regularly. I mean, I'm a huge advocate of physical exercise, not just for cognitive health, but for mental health as well. Making sure that your sleep's right, that you're getting your sleep hygiene optimized so that you're sleeping well. Making sure that you're eating healthily. There's a lot of data out there about poor diets and how they can sometimes induce states of depression and perpetuate depression. So diet is another sort of really important factor. And then doing what you can to reduce the things that may be causing the depression, which obviously can be hard sometimes, but trying to find out what the stresses are in your life, what's driving it, seeing whether you can kind of do anything about that. And if you can't, then really talking to somebody, which might initially be just family or friends and so on, just to sort of share the problem, that can be helpful. If you don't have that or that's not sufficient, then involving somebody sort of professionally to talk through these difficulties can be really helpful. So counselors, clinical psychologists and so on. And there are some very well-known therapies such as CBT, which are really helpful for people with depression, which sort of essentially challenge the thoughts that arise when you're depressed and allow you to, I suppose, reprocess them in a more helpful way. And those therapies can be really very helpful for a lot of people. So lifestyle interventions, if you like, psychological strategies for some. And then for others, I think we do have a lot of medications which can be very helpful to be used, at least in the short term. There's a fair degree of cynicism about antidepressants. And I have to acknowledge that there's a lot that we don't know about how they work, and they certainly don't work for everybody. But for other people, they are literally life-saving, and they can make a huge difference to people's lives. So I think having a conversation with your doctor about the role of these medications is really important if the other things are not working. And we have a lot of choices in terms of antidepressants. And we know, for instance, that some of the antidepressants, or treating depression more generally, actually can reduce your risk of things like dementia later on as well. So actually treating the depression may reduce the risk of dementia. So there's many reasons that this stuff should be adequately addressed.
Excellent. We touched on this ever so briefly earlier in the conversation, but I just wanted to ask you more about the possibility that a person can have dementia, depression, and delirium all at the same time. It's extremely complicated. What does that look like? Where does a medical practitioner start? Can you, please talk us through that?
Yeah, so I would say that's Well, certainly delirium and dementia very commonly co-occur. And I think you can have a clinical presentation that looks like depression quite commonly occur with those things as well. So we do see it. And delirium itself can cause changes in mood. Dementia can cause changes in mood that sort of look like depression, although it may not be the clinical depression per se. So they do very commonly coexist, and each one of those conditions probably makes it more likely that the other conditions will occur. So I think my approach with these things is to try and understand what the most likely problem is, or what it almost have a hierarchy to them. So I think if there's any sense that there is a delirium process occurring, you really do need to do all those kind of investigations and rule that out. And unless there's an acute need to treat the depression, you might focus on that first, because it might be that when you resolve the delirium, the depression sort of largely dissipates. So I think delirium, because it's often this very reversible, treatable cause, is probably something that I really have at the top of my mind when I'm thinking about how to approach these issues and how to kind of treat them. So we look for the delirium red flags, we treat them as best we can. And then I suppose below that, if you like, then that's when we might be thinking about the depression. If the delirium symptoms appear to have settled, but the person's still got those sort of pervasive low mood and those other symptoms, then that's when we would really be focusing on treating the depression. And doing that, as we mentioned before sort of concluding about any sort of process of dementia occurring. I would say a lot of the time we do end up doing some of this stuff at the same time. So if somebody has depressive features or they have symptoms of delirium, we will check them for this possible underlying dementia as well. But it's just that you wouldn't necessarily perhaps be quite as concrete in terms of your conclusion about dementia being present, and you wouldn't jump on treatment for dementia, for instance, before perhaps you treated the delirium, because you don't, even if they do have dementia, you don't know what their baseline is. It might be that what looks like a severe dementia is actually a mild dementia plus delirium. So really getting a sort of clear sense of how delirium fits into the picture is really important before you make conclusions about the severity of the dementia, which then dictates the treatment plan for them.
Excellent. So we have many family carers, formal caregivers, and providers tuning into the show. What advice can you offer these carers, whether that's at home, in the person's own home, or in a residential care setting, that would alert them to something being different with the older person, that they weren't themselves, that they might think about acting on?
I think that comment about them not being themselves, that's actually so critical. And obviously, they will know the person a lot better often than we do as medical doctors. And so I think their observations are actually really crucial, and because they know that there's been some sort of change. So I think being vocal in that and just, you know, being open to talking to the doctors about the fact that you have noticed this change is really important, and not forgetting to speak up about it. And don't have to say much, but just to say they're not themselves, something has changed, and just making that point very obviously. I think looking out for those sudden changes as a carer, that's really important. So that sudden change could be confusion, or it could be a change in behavior. It could be withdrawal of some kind. It could be sort of agitation. It could be some of these frightening things, like the hallucinations you're mentioning your father had. So any sort of sudden changes like that, I think, is really important to notice. And if that's happening, you should be speaking to somebody medically that can actually sort of address it as well. We know from the stats, I think the estimate is that around 70% of cases of delirium are actually picked up by carers rather than medical staff. So they're in a much better position to be able to do it. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose that's the message. You need to have faith in your own observations and your own evaluation that the person's different, and you need to kind of speak up about it and seek help earlier rather than later.
Excellent. This has been another very informative conversation, Kailas. I've really enjoyed discussing this topic with you today, a topic that has always interested me. And I know our listeners are going to learn a lot from our discussion today. We have Kailas's details in the show notes, listeners, if you want to follow up with him and his clinic. And we also have the link to Kailas's book, Mind Your Brain, which I can certainly recommend as an excellent resource and worth taking the time to read. Kailas, thank you so much for joining us today. Until next week, listeners, here's to your good brain health.
Thanks very much, Coral.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode. Do you have a topic that you'd like us to cover on an episode? Please reach out and let us know via social media or our website, cmeacn.com.au. That's cmeacn.com.au. All the links are in the show notes. And don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button so you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes.